We are in Paragimel, chapter 3, Pasuk Chafhei, sentence 25. The adventures of Ehud ben Gera. Getting to the end of that story now. So if you remember the story, the Jews are under Moab at this point. Moab led by King Eglon. We talked about the role of Moab as, just like we had seen with Aram, Moab as an antagonist of the Jews. They are the ones who also had sort of split off from the Jews and are perennial opposites, the trait of Moab being the trait of stinginess in particular and greed. Ehud's plot is that he comes in with a gift as part of the group of Jews who are there as a delegation to give a gift to Eglon. He's with the group, he leaves with the group, and then he comes back solo afterwards. And the idea there, we explained, was, number one, it's easier to escape if you're alone. You don't have to worry about the group. But also, they would let their guard down. They wouldn't be afraid of this lone guy who came with the group and then left, and then just remembered that he had something he had to say. And so he comes to Eglon, and he says, "I have a secret for you." Everybody else clears out. And then he says to Eglon, "I have a message from God." And Eglon stands up for that message from God. And we talked about last week the reward that he gets. That was in sentence 20. The reward that Eglon gets for this sign of respect for God, as well as this idea that that's a precedent for the practice of standing during Kaddish. And then, once Eglon has done this really nice thing of standing up out of respect for God, Ehud stabs him in the gut. And he is a lefty, and therefore Eglon doesn't see it coming. He pulls out the dagger, and he shoves it in to the all the way to the hilt. And that was the idea of a double-edged sword, meaning that unlike a knife, where it has a flat side and then a blade, and it wouldn't be as easy to stab it straight in, this actually is two blades coming to a point, and therefore it goes right into Eglon, and Eglon is so bari, as we said, he is so healthy, slash large, that that the blade goes all the way in, and he's not agile enough to strike back at Ehud. He doesn't seem to cry out because nobody outside knows what's going on, unless the answer is that really that room was just so far removed from where everybody was that nobody heard him. Ehud leaves, locks the door behind him from the outside, not from the inside. He locks the door. That was what we concluded. He locked the door from the outside and he fled. The guards show up, and that was in Pasuk Chaftal, sentence 24. The guards show up, they see that the doors are locked, and locked, again, from the outside. And so they figure that means that Ehud left, and he locked the door. It must be the king wants privacy, he must be using the washroom. And so they don't want to go in and check on him, because they don't want to disturb him. And so we're up to Pasuk Chafhei, sentence 25. Vayachilu ad bosh. So they wait until bosh. We're used to the term busha to mean embarrassment, but that's not what it means here. We'll see a little bit more about this in a moment, but basically it means they're waiting and waiting, and it's clearly late. There's no reason for it to be taking this long. The king is not opening the doors. They took the key. That's another way you know that it was locked from the outside, because otherwise they couldn't have unlocked it. They took the key by Yiftachu and they opened it up. V'hine adonehem nofel arza mace. And lo and behold, the king Eglon is dead. Ve'ehud nimlat ad hismah meham. In the meantime, Ehud has fled while they're all, procrastinating there outside the room. V'hu avaris hapsilin. And he passed the quarry. He passed the quarry where he had left the group, and he runs to what sounds like Seir, but it can't be Seir, because Seir is entirely wrong geographically for where they are. So the assumption is, as Rashi says, that it really does not mean Seir the place, rather Seir like Seir, like hair. It's a tangled forest. It's a good place to hide. So before we get to what happens next, we used a couple of words that are worth looking at here. It's a good example of what Malbim likes to do. If you look back at the psukim in Chaf Dalid, Chaf Hei, and Chavav. How many different words do we use to describe the guards delaying opening the door?
Bosh
is one, right?
Hit mamam,
right? Mamea is to, is also to wait. And one more word. No, that's the term for using the washroom. Wasn't there another one? The echa, right?
Where is that?
The. Where was it? One second. No, where was it? It was Vayachilu. It was Vayachilu at Bosh was one. Hisma Maham was the second one. I used the word Echar here because Maldum does, but maybe he must have been using it from another place because I don't see it there. Take a look at what I brought in from the Maldum on the sheet, and we'll work from that. He says, Yesh Hevdel Bein Mitmahmeya Boshesh and Echar. The difference between these three terms. Hitmahmeya, all three of them are used to refer to taking a long time, but Hitmahmeya Hu Hefech HaChash. Chash is to rush. Lihitmahmeya is the opposite of rushing to be hasty. Shu bilti mimaher. It means you're not going quickly, vizariz, and you're not being energetic. Rak mitakev, you're delaying, taking your time. So lihitmahmeya is to delay, to stall. So Mashiach is v'acha pisha yitmahmeya. Lot doesn't want to leave Sodom. He's mitmahmeya. The same term.
Also, right?
With the.
Right,
leyachuli hitmahmeya. Correct. They couldn't wait for the dough to rise. Good. V'haboshesh, who im mitakev yosem min haraoi. Boshesh is if someone is taking longer than is appropriate. In other words, it's not so much about the fact that it's slow as there's a certain amount of time it should take, and boshesh is longer than that. It isn't that there's an appointed time, though, and I'm going to come back to that because I think that's actually, for a separate reason, it's an important point. V'hameacher, who has the term la'acher, which we also use to refer to someone being late, hu hameacher zman kavua. That's to be later than an appointed time. There was a time, and now I am later than that. So three different terms for delaying. The reason this matters to Malbim is because Malbim is a preacher of what's called omnisignificance. The idea that every word in Tanakh has special meaning. Because one of the big things for Malbim is that he's around in the early days of reform and criticism of the biblical text, in which people are saying that the text is written by human beings and there's things that are extra and so forth. And Malbim wants to prove that every nuance in a sentence is actually significant, has special meaning. And so he's going to show you that even though you have these three different words that are used for being late, they're not really the same word. One refers to someone going slowly, one refers to someone taking longer than you expect, and one is when there's actually an appointed time, and he's not there. So to give you one particular example in which this is significant, when Moshe is up on Har Sinai, and the Jews say, he isn't back, right? Where is Moshe? It says, Vayar Ha'am ki Boshesh. Good. Ki Boshesh Moshe. The nation sees that Moshe is Boshesh. The word Boshesh is a funny word. What does that mean, Boshesh Moshe? So, the usual explanation that's offered for Boshesh Moshe is what? That they miscount the days. It's this whole medrash, right? That there was a certain Moshe supposed to come back after 40 days, and they miscounted. As a matter of fact, Rashi even quotes a medrash to that effect that says, Boshesh is Ba-Shesh. The sixth hour had come, and yet Moshe wasn't there. Because they're all basing this on the idea that there was a set time for Moshe to be back. Moshe appears to have missed the time. And therefore, they panic. However, number one, that's not what Malbim thinks, because how did Malbim use the term Boshesh?
Especially if there's no specific time that they should have
been. Right, it's just longer than it should have been. We don't know why he's up on the mountain this long. That's number one. Number two, if you look in the Psukim, it does not appear that Moshe had given them a particular time. At the end of Parshas Mishpatim, Moshe gives them his last speech before going up the mountain. And then after his speech is over, it then says Moshe went up and Moshe was there for 40 days and 40 nights. But it does not say that Moshe told them he was going to be there for 40 days and 40 nights. And it's very clear to me, at any rate, that when you read the Psukim, Moshe was not supposed to be there for only 40 days and 40 nights. How do you know that Moshe was not supposed to be there for just 40 days and 40 nights? How do you know that that's true?
No,
it's not there. There's a better way to know.
Klal complained that he was supposed to, that he didn't come down.
Right, like, so that's the first view.
Right,
that's the first view that we mentioned, that Boshesh actually would mean that he's supposed to be, that he's supposed to be back already. The problem is Malvim says Boshesh doesn't mean that. He says Boshesh means there's an expectation of how long something should take, and he's already past that. But you know it from the story itself, you know. What does Hashem say to Moshe to get Moshe to go down the mountain?
He says,
it's Shmos Perek Lamed Beis. He says, Lech rei ki shicheis amcha. Asher Elisa, etc. Go down because your nation has become corrupt. In other words, Moshe is leaving because the babysitter called, right? That's why Moshe is leaving.
And yet then why did the Jews say he's late?
The babysitter didn't call, actually. That's part of the problem.
But they just
so that's the thing.
Isn't the whole point is that it's subjective? Like, it's from your perspective.
Yeah.
And ever so wait, for, I can't find where it says Malchir.
It doesn't. Malbim is just borrowing that because it's not
you.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, no, Malbim must not. Malbim is just pointing it out because it's another word that we use in Tanakh for being late. But in terms of this, but thank you for looking. In terms of this particular story, what we're seeing here is there are two schools of thought in the Egel. There's one school of thought, which is Rashi, which is the Medrash that says there was a set time, and Moshe blew past that time. And there are other reasons to say that. One reason that's offered, and this is part of what the Medrash is picking up on, is that it says, Vayar ha'am ki boshesh Moshe. The nation saw. What does that mean? How do you see that someone isn't there? So you could say seeing is perception rather than sight, and that would be a simple read. But that's where the Medrash gets the idea that the Satan shows them Moshe's body, also because they say to Aaron, Zeh Moshe ha'ish, asher ha'elanu me'aretz Mitzrayim. Zeh, this. And the word Zeh, or the word Zot, in Chumash, is usually you're pointing to something specific, something visible. The Zeh Maaseh HaMenorah, there are a bunch of uses like that. Zeh Yitnu. So the word Zeh indicates that they saw something specific, and that's where you get this whole body of thought that says Moshe was expected at a certain time, he didn't show up, the Satan made things worse by showing them his dead body, and they panicked. But what Malvim is saying here is consistent with the other school of thought, which is, no, there was no particular time that Moshe was supposed to be back, but they're getting nervous, and especially if you take the Kuzari's read of the story, Kuzari says the Jews never left Har Sinai. In other words, the Jews spend 40 days standing at the mountain, waiting, just like, we don't know when he's coming back. He just said, I'm going up the mountain, and then I'm going to be back. He didn't say when. So they're all like, Moshe's coming. We got the Torah. It's so exciting. When is he, you know, what's he going to bring us? And he's not showing up. And after 40 days, they just snap. Like,
right.
Something's just wrong. We need something else. And probably not after 40 days either. This has been building over time. And at that point, it just snaps. Which just builds the question of, so what did God think he was doing with them? But that's another story. The point that I'm making here is simply that Malbim, by saying Boshesh means longer than is appropriate, is actually weighing in on what's happening in the Egel. But to go back to the point here, where they're all waiting for the king, somewhat more mundane. V'hine t'chila himtinu ad hisman naham. He's picking up on the way the wording goes in the Navi. So the first it said, they waited to the point of being mitmahmeya, which is what it says, Ehud nimlat ad hismamaham. Ehud ran away while they were being mitmahmeya, meaning they were not hurrying to get him out. Ki chashvu shamei sichu as raglov, v'derach lismameyu lisakei, and they thought he's using the washroom and it's going to take time. But afterwards, as the pasuk says, they wait until boshesh, meaning yosir mishir haroi. It's longer than it should be. And then they took the key and opened it. But Ehud already ran away after the first stage when they were just, you know, taking their time, which was a normal period of time. He didn't think that they were going to take longer than the appropriate time. He didn't wait for Boshesh. He ran away at Mithmameya. And he rushed to get out while they would, before they would get to that later stage of delay. So what Malbim is doing in terms of our psukim is simply explaining why the psukim use different terminology for the delay. So the way to read Pasuk Chav Hey is they waited until it was past when it should have been. He wasn't opening the doors. They took the key and he was lying there on the ground dead. And Ehud had run away while they were still in the first stage of delaying. That's the way that he explains it, and that's why you have different words. All because Malbim wants to make sure that you know that every word in Tanakh has a unique meaning. So he has now demonstrated that.
Is there a reason, besides just explaining the storyline, that they would say that? Like, are they blaming the guards, saying they really should have done it earlier? Are they saying that Ehud didn't plan that his locking the door would cause that action, or does it not matter and it's just the storyline?
Right, so if I take Ralbag's approach, and I don't know that he makes this comment here, but it would be consistent with his approach in general. Ralbag is a very practical person. And so at the end of every couple of prakim in Navi, he will give you a set of lessons you learn from a story, some of which are ethical lessons, some of which are religious lessons, and some of which are practical lessons, like this is how you wage war. Here are lessons in war that you can learn from, you know, whatever chapter. So I would not be surprised to see at the end of these two chapters that he's going to point out that even though Ehud planned a delay, which would likely be long enough that it would reach Boshesh stage, nonetheless, he didn't play games. He ran out at the Mameya stage, from which we learn that even when you have a plan that should give you to hear, nonetheless, make sure you're expeditious about carrying it out and don't delay. I think there is that sort of practical message. Okay, so Ehud is now on the run. He has gotten out in advance of the guards realizing what's going on. And we are now at Pasuk Chav Zayin. Vayehi bevo'o, and it was when he arrived back at the Jewish camp, vayiska b'shofar b'har Ephraim, and he blows the shofar on Mount Ephraim, Mount Ephraim being, once again, this major location for Jewish life in Israel. Vayerdu imo b'nei Yisrael min ha'har, the Jews descend with him from the mountain, they're ready, because the rest of the group knew what he was doing. And so therefore they're part of the plan. They've been, you know, rounding everybody up. V'hulif nehem, and he is in front of them. V'yomar alehem, and he says to them, Ridfu acharai, run after me, kinasan Hashem esayvechem es Moav biedchem, because God has given your enemies Moav into your hands. Note that he credits Hashem. Right? Hashem is the one who has done this. It's not me. I maybe was a little daring. You know, I stabbed the king, and, you know, she got credit for that. But at the end of the day, this is God. Vayodu acharav, they race after him. Vayokidu es mabiros hayardein limoav, velodnas nu kishla avor. This is a little tricky. They captured mabirot hayardein. Mabirot, from the word ayin bet resh, to cross. These are the crossings of the Yarden. So the question is, what were they doing? What were they doing when they destroy the crossings, or they capture the crossings of the Yarden? They didn't let anybody cross.
Yeah.
Moab couldn't
cross over.
Nobody,
right, the troops can't come and join or anything.
Right, so there are two possibilities. Ruth,
what
did you
say?
No,
that's what I said. They blocked the
maybe the
Jews can't go
there either.
Yeah. The place where they would cross.
Right, so there are two possibilities. One possibility is, remember that Moab started out east of the Yarden. They then raided and came into Israel and dominated the area where the Jews lived. But fundamentally, home is east of the Yarden. So one possibility, the simple read, is that by taking the crossings, you cut off Moab, who are living in Ir HaTzmarim and Yericho, from reinforcements back home. And that way, you've now split them in two. That's a reasonable read. Radak, though, suggests that they actually went further. They were not content with eradicating the Moabites who had, you know, been dominating the Jews all these decades in Israel. They then went east. In other words, they capture the crossings, and now they're going to go attack Moab at home. They're going further. Not clear either way, but either one is a reasonable read. Vayakues Moab ba'isahi. They conquer Moab at that point. Ka'asaras alafim ish, like 10,000 men, kol sham, meaning the soldiers that the Jews had, kol shamein v'chol ish chayil. Shamein doesn't mean what you think it is. Any more than bari meant it. It meant large people. Kol shamein v'chol ish chayil. Chayil being a term that we associate at this time of year with Rus, right? Because she is known as Eshet Chayil. Chayil can mean different things in Tanakh. The one thing it probably does not mean is valor. apologies. But Chayil means, sometimes it means wealth, sometimes it means strength, sometimes it means general status. So Chayil here, presumably Chayil in the military context. These are people of strength. Velo nimlat ish. The chayil part is true, but kol shamein v'chol ish chayil is a reference to the plishtim, to the Moabites. In other words, all of the Moabites who were shamein and ish chayil were all destroyed, and lo nimlat me'am ish, lo nimlat ish, not one of them got away. That would be the way to read. So it's not our people; it's their people. Vatikana Moab Bayom Haru Tachas Yad Yisrael. Moab is humbled before the Jews at that point. Vatishkot Haaretz Shmonim Shana. And we get 80 years of peace and quiet at that point. They have been under them for 18 years. And now you have 80 years, although Mitzvah David says it's actually 80 years from the beginning of the enslavement to Moab. It's 62 good years. 18 bad years and 62 good years, which is important just because when you sit down and try to do the chronology of the Shoftim, right, in terms of who was when, it's part of the question of when was a Shofet appointed. The question is it 80 years after the 18 or is it 80 years including? So much stuff of it says 80 years including.
So did they only capture the Moabites on Israel side, or did...
Take defense who you take.
Okay.
You could really win it either way. Yeah. They're not.
It's a pretty hefty thing to capture the Moabites who are all, right?
Yes.
On the east side.
Yep.
But it's realistic to maybe on the west side to have done that.
Right.
How does just defeating the king all of a sudden, oh, now you could take, like, really, it's one person. I know it's the king, but where was his army? They can't function if they don't have a king.
Well, his army is here. They're dead. You're asking how they succeeded in defeating them?
Well, all of a sudden they king, and all of a sudden they can take out. Like, they never did their job of taking them over, and now all of a sudden they take them over.
Right. Keep in mind that Moab is in a weak position from the beginning. They're not in their home base. They've extended themselves into the land, and they may have forces, but realistically, if all he had, let's say the 10,000 were actually the ones he had in Israel proper, and let's say they didn't go back home. So we're maximizing the Moabite presence west of the Yarden. 10,000 is not an awful lot.
So like
to hold a country.
Now, why did they do it before?
Right, and to which the answer would be they're intimidated by Moab. They're intimidated by the king. They're intimidated by Moab in general. Remember, they've blended into the Canaanites of the land. They've become like them. There's no sense that God is on our side. There's no confidence like that. So, all right, we'll pay tribute to Moab. But what Ehud does is he rallies them and he shows them, no, this is something we can do, and he kills the king, and that gives them the opportunity to revolt. I think that's really, a lot of it is really about confidence. So that is Ehud. And in contrast to Ehud, where we have this whole drawn-out story of what he did, we get one sentence for the next one. V'achrav haya Shamgar ben Anat. After Ehud was Shamgar ben Anat, Vayaches Plishtim Shesh Meos Ish b'Malmad HaBakar, and he struck the Plishtim 600 men with a cattle goad, Vayosha Gamhu es Yisrael, and he also saved Israel. The cattle goat is what you use for cattle. No, the it's a stick with a sharp end. You want to get them to move along, right? Like goading somebody, right? Like a prod, yeah. That kind of thing. But I think goad is a legitimate word. Well, it is, but then you have to ask yourself once again, like, there were 600 Plishtim controlling all the Jews. You know, how many hundreds of thousands, or really millions, of Jews are there? 600 men? So, we need to understand what's going on in this story, as well as the issue of the Plishtim. It's not clear that the Plishtim have the same identity that, like, you know, Moab and Aram, you know, have for us, or that Canaan, for that matter, is going to have when we see Canaan next. We know a little bit about the people who live in Gerar from the story with Abimelech. You know, there's a sense of also inappropriate behavior, lack of Yirat Elokim. There's a sense of jealousy among them, where they see the wells and the success of Yitzchak, and they saw the success of Abram, and they fill in the wells and they drive them off. So maybe that's sort of their trait. But we don't have a better sense of the Plishtim, and especially because they're not necessarily even the Plishtim yet. We talked about this when we introduced the Sefer, about the fact that the Plishtim invade from the northwest. Until that time, people who are called Plishtim are simply raiders who have come into the area. They're Polshim. They're people who raid, and they live in the area that we'll call Pleshet. But they're not necessarily the people who later become these main antagonists of the Jews. So it's not so clear in terms of assigning them an identity the way it is with the others. But at some point, they must have attacked us. That's what it sounds like. And we get this fellow Shamgar ben Anat. So we don't know anything about him. He's got one sentence. Now, look, that's one more sentence than I have. But but
you don't know yet. One day.
Yeah. But Abar Benel, in his introduction to the Sefer, when he tries to show you that they were shoftim from each Shevet, so Abar Benel argues that Shamgar ben Anat may have been from the city of Anatot, which you all know because that was the Haftarah by Shabbos. The beautifully linked in Shul, as a matter of fact. So Anatot is a city of Kohanim, so he suggests that that Shamgar must be a Kohen, being from the city of Anatot. The problem is that Anat was actually a Canaanite goddess. So what do you do with that one?
We have a Shamgar.
Ostensibly, yes. But either way, what are you doing with that name? So there are all sorts of suggestions that are made, but not with any real evidence. There's one in particular I saw that was very interesting. They found arrowheads in the Galil, dating back to the period of the 11th to 12th century before the Common Era, which is roughly Shoftim period, and inscribed on them are the words Ben Anat. Mm-hmm. Now, it would be even cooler if they found a cattle goat.
Right, yeah.
Wow.
But that is interesting. It suggests that it was some kind of a warrior name, certainly, if you're going to find it written on the arrowheads.
So it's what the idea of getting with Shoftim is that it was like regional small issues that each judge was dealing with, or was it dealing with the nation as a whole going
right.
to war?
So this is a very good question, and it's going to become the central question in the next parak, meaning the story of Devorah, because Devorah is going to try to rally everybody, and she's not going to succeed. She's going to get half the tribes, and the other half are not going to come, and then in parak hey, she's going to criticize the ones who didn't show up. So it definitely seems like the Jews have sort of balkanized into, well, you're the Har Ephraim region, you're the east of the Yarden region, and you're the, you know, maybe up in the northwest versus the ones who are in the Plishti area, and they each have their own concerns. We talked about it a little bit when we did the introduction to the Sefer, how when the Jews start to go native and become like the tribes that are around them, it's entirely possible for them to sort of identify more with their Canaanite neighbors than with their distant cousins who are living in different parts of the land. So yeah, that definitely becomes a major theme in the Sefer. And yes, it could be that he's dealing with an issue that's in the southwest. They're dealing with... Yeah, it's possible. It doesn't say how long he reigned, right? After him was Shamgar ben Anat, he struck the Plishtim, and he also saved Israel, and that's it. No mention of how long things were quiet, no mention of anything.
It was probably very short.
And maybe he was during.
So it would appear. Sorry, maybe he's during
maybe
what?
Maybe he's during the 80 years.
Could be.
Or he's during that.
To add to the mess, take a look at Perek Dalet Pasuk Aleph, the next Pasuk. Vayosifu b'nei Yisrael la'asos hara b'nei Hashem. The Jews continued to do that which was bad in God's eyes. Ehud mate, and Ehud was dead.
So that justifies last thing. Yeah. The 8 years, he was in the middle of Ehud, and then
right, because otherwise you should have a Shamgar mate.
Yeah.
Right, by saying Ehud.
Why do we need him if Ehud's around?
Maybe he was just a warrior.
Maybe he was
just
a
harab
after
him.
Yeah, this is a problem. If it was really true that he was during Ehud's time, then it shouldn't say an after him.
He was dead.
Usually, when you're after somebody else, that is what it means.
You don't need a leader after his story, like after his whole region, so maybe he just helped this little region. He helped a little town in Plishtim.
But it still says after his war.
Maybe after his life. Maybe he's not then.
I mean, there are a lot of different ways that we can deal with this problem, and we'll see more of it in a moment. But the first question of before when he lived, the question is how long did he reign? The number's not there. So Abarbanel mentions a drash. He says there is this statement of our sages, but I can't find it anywhere. The one place where I found it quoted, besides Abarbanel, is actually Josephus. In source number 2, Josephus, in his Antiquities of the Jews, says, in his accounting of the Shoftim, after him, meaning Ehud, Shamgar the son of Anat was elected for their governor but died in the first year of his government. So, it still doesn't give us where he fits, but it does tell us it's 1 year. And that's what Abarbanel quotes as the 1 year idea.
Could be less.
Exactly. Right, within a year.
Could have been so short.
But it mattered or it wouldn't be in there. Like, it mattered or there wouldn't be a sentence.
Right. It mattered, but it was so insignificant.
I don't think it says it was.
Right, so I'm going to come back to... Well, I'm going to come back to the question of why it mattered. Why his actions mattered. But take a look at Ralbag in source number 3. Because Ralbag tries to give us sort of a global picture that will address both the question of how long he lived and when. V'lomana kama shanim haisa Yeshua al Yisrael yado. It didn't enumerate how many years he saved Israel. It appears it wasn't a complete salvation, right? Consistent with the idea that he knocked out 600 people, which, at the end of the day, isn't going to save you from the Plishtim. He says, it already says, as we just read, that the Jews continue to perform that which is evil in God's eyes after the death of Ehud. So what am I going to do? The answer is, Shamgar is after Ehud, but within the period when Yavin, king of Canaan, oppresses Israel leading up to Devorah. So in other words, what we're saying is, Ehud, to the end of the 80, Ehud dies, Shamgar is the shofet, for a year, when Yavin, king of Canaan, is already oppressing the Jews. Shamgar does not succeed against the Plishtim, against the Canaanim. He does succeed against the Plishtim, which may be a minor regional issue, like Linda was suggesting. But fundamentally, the Jews are living under Yavin at this point. And the reign of Shamgar is completely overshadowed by what happens with Canaan and then ultimately with Devorah.
So why say the Yashag Gam Hu at Israel?
Well, he did do something. He knocked out 600 Plishtim. Did we call Ehud a Shofet? We did not call Shamgar, that's for sure. Did we see... Let's see. V'akam Hashem Moshia livnei Yisrael by Yoshiaim in the days of Otniel. Otniel it said by Yishpot.
Yeah.
The Ehud, it just said Moshia. It did not mention anything about him being Shofet. That's true. Leva, you were going to say?
No, but it says that he saved them, so we can't really say that he didn't succeed. But I guess he saved...
On a small level, on a regional level.
That doesn't really say that.
Yeah, but he said he saved them.
Israel.
Like, exactly.
Let's say, like, he saved the city.
But,
yes, and saved Israel.
True.
And it also says gamhu, like, as if he is an
inheritor.
Exactly.
With Ehud.
Yeah, but they're both not.
That's how I would read it.
Well, what he is saying here, what Rabbagi is saying, definitely fits with Perek Dalet Pasuk Aleph and the fact that it starts with Ehud's death, because it's after Ehud's death that Canaan begins its control, not after Shamgar's death. The issue of the overlap is discussed by others. It appears others ask the same question. It also fits a completely different idea, which we already mentioned at one point from the beginning of the Medrash on Rus, when Rus begins by Hibimei Shifod HaShoftim, and we said at the time, the period when the Jews judged their judges, right? It was the days of the judging of the judges rather than judging by the judges. So the that kind of negative, because we don't find Shamgar leading the Jews back to proper behavior, that's not referenced here, and because that medrash says it says who are the shoftim that we're talking about, Ehud and Shamgar. Those are the two. So that also sort of floats this idea. Although maybe that would put him back in Ehud's days. Maybe that's not such a good idea.
So you're saying there weren't such good shoftim like these two?
Not all the shoftim are successful. I'm not saying he's not good, but that he's not successful. But what we do see clearly here, the fact that we don't mention the Jews getting any better, is the decline of the Jews. Ehud led the Jews, and they fought back, and they had silence, from the enemy. We don't get anything like that when you're dealing with Shamgar. Now, the cattle goad, and this we go to Shauna's question of what's the importance of what he accomplished here. What is this emphasis on the cattle goad?
Maybe it's just that wasn't a usual thing to use, and he was extremely successful in a way that nobody else was.
He has a presence.
That's why he has a presence. But also, if you think about it, you asked the question before about, well, he just killed the king. That was one person that he killed, and it gave them enough motivation to fight back. Maybe killing 600 people was enough motivation in this case for them to take the next stage. Although afterwards, we learned
the next passage just says that they
continue to do. I know, but that's before.
It's interesting though that they talk so much about the weapons, like the weapon that Ehud used. You know, like it was this double-edged sword, and now this is a cattle goad. Like different ways of. I don't know, they're evolving in terms of their weaponry.
Maybe the cattle goat or the ox goat was something like the serpent or the snake, like Moshe used it was like a miracle thing.
Right. So in terms of this, in terms of the goat, we see three different ideas. One idea, which Abarbanel states, is that the goat is meant to emphasize that he's not a real warrior. In other words, he doesn't have weapons. Mm-hmm. This is what he had. In which case, it's important to realize it is as much a part of the story as Ehud's sword. In other words, Ehud's double-edged sword was part of the story. It explained how he could do what he did. And the cattle goat is part of the story because it tells you what kind of person this was. And the fact that he did this with a cattle goat, and he took his cane, and just whacked them over the head. That's one approach. And along with that, you could suggest that this emphasizes a miracle. That this is, in fact, as Linda's suggesting, a miraculous thing. Others suggest that maybe one of the Plishti methods of conquest was that they didn't allow the Jews to have the material they could use to make weapons. We don't get the metal. And that's why, this is what he has. He has a calico, and that's what code, and that's what he's going to use. But it's true. We're going to see it further along as well, that the weapon actually has great significance in the story. We've seen two so far, but we're going to see more. Yael is going to be one of them. Shimshon is going to be another. The weapons of Shoftim could be a class in its own right. Maybe after we finish Shoftim, I can do a Shoftim.
There are no weapons.
Sorry, Ruth, what?
Yeah, could it be that, militarily, as far as the weapons that they had were not, they weren't so strong.
And it's showing that Hashem is on their side, and he's actually controlling this.
Right, and that was the idea that Linda had suggested, that it's, you know, this is indeed miraculous.
Yeah. I mean, with all of them, I mean, with Ehud as well, and as you say, Shimshon and Yael, you know, I mean, the chances that you succeed in these primitive kind of methods.
Well, Ehud is, I think, in a different class, because Ehud actually is a pretty good weapon.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. But I think the weapon is part of the story. It's not random. Things like this, you know, matter a great deal. They influence the story.
I mean, it's the same thing with David as well.
You mean Goliath, yeah. That's true.
But what about the fact that it says that he saved them, right? That he too saved them. But then the next passage doesn't acknowledge at all that there's any change between them from when Ahab said
it. Could it be that he just wasn't actually a leader? In general, I mean, he wasn't a shofet, he was just an individual.
Well, by saying
after these events, acharav means after these events.
Yeah.
He went off the position.
Well, acharav means, no, after him, after Ehud. Yeah, it suggests that he has some kind of position like Ehud did.
Okay. Tell us that he too saved Sir Israel, so we're comparing it to someone else that saved him, meaning
right.
That would be the past one.
So, the truth of the matter is that we have a fundamental problem, which is that Pasuk Lamed Aleph, sentence 31, says, as you noted, he saved Israel. But on the other hand, number one, it doesn't sound like you saved them if you defeated, you know, 600 of them. And number two, the opening of the next parak doesn't sound like he saved them either. And we've now decided that Yodin was king, you know, and over them. So, in fact, it's a machlokas in the Mefarshim, the commentators also. Abar Benel says, 600 is not a huge number, but he saved the Jews anyway. You're right. 600 is not a huge number, but it was what was needed. Ralbag, on the other hand, says no. Ralbag said, we already saw it in number 3, that it was an incomplete victory. Mitzudat David does that also. He has a funny read. He says, Vayoshag Gamhu es Yisrael, suggests not he also saved like Ehud did, but it's sort of like, yeah, he also did something. It's sort of a negative also. It's like, yeah, he was good too. No, it wasn't such a great victory. And Malbim picks up on this too. If you take a look at source number 4 on your sheets, it says, "V'chol zeh tshu'a mu'etes." All of this was a small salvation. "Ba'ofen shebe'isahi hayekitzar rishon sh'amar b'akdamas ha'sefer v'gamel shoftehem lo shameyu." Because this was a period which was, like we said in the beginning of the book, that they didn't listen to the shoftim. That's the kind of era this was. Which is why it doesn't say, in fact, that he judged Israel.
Do we see that with Ehud?
So Ehud, we said also, it didn't say Vayishvot. This is a downward
maybe
part.
They didn't
judge. Yeah. But he wasn't judging. In other words,
that's what I'm saying. Was there another judge at the same time?
There's overlap.
He was just a military leader, or
if we put him under the Canaanim, then Devorah is your shofet of the time who is successful. We don't know. We also, I mean, we still have the same problem that we've had since the beginning of the sefer, which is what is a shofet? Is a shofet a judge? Is a shofet a leader? Is a shofet supposed to be both? Is this just a broad job description, and whoever arises shapes it, you know, to whatever suits them in their time? We still don't have clarity. So, to summarize what has been actually a fairly long chapter, we began with nations being left in the land, and, you know, we have to learn war, which we hadn't had to do when we were getting miracles. Aram, the nation who Avram and Sarah left, attack us when we regress, and righteous Othniel ben Kenaz leads us back. Moab, the nation of Lot and of greed, rallies Ammon and Amalek to attack us when we regress, and Ehud ben Gera heroically leads us back. The Plishti oppress us, and Shamgar leads some kind of unclear victory, and the people at this point are wicked. They're not even being judged. None of that is happening. And all of that sets the stage for Devorah. Ready for Devorah? Okay. Now, there's an awful lot to be said just to introduce Devorah. So let's see how much we'll actually succeed in covering. I gave you the outline of the two prakim on your sheet. The first parak is the story. The second parak is Devorah's poem, although it's worth recognizing that there are details of the story that only come out when you read the poem. If you learn only one parak, you're missing details of the story. You need both prakim, as we'll see. The basic outline, though, is the introductions of what's happening with the Jews at this point, who is Devorah, the plan that Devorah makes compelling Barak to go to war, the initial attack against the Canaanim, routing the Canaanim, the downfall of Sisera at the hands of Yael, and then the aftermath. That's the basic storyline. And then Devorah's poem begins. She thanks God. She gives an invocation and then talks about how terrible things were under Canaan. Talks about how the war was prosecuted, the military victory, Yael's victory, and then you get this very strange passage at the end with Sisera's mother. So there are actually three female protagonists in this story. You have Devorah, you have Yael, and you have Sisera's mother. And so that has to figure into the lessons that we're going to learn within the story, is seeing the differences among the three. The themes that we're going to see in this story, the challenge of uniting the tribes for battle, Devorah being the first shofet with a visibly religious role, meaning beyond the Vayishpot reference that we saw. This is going to be much stronger as a religious role than we've seen before. She is the only one so far to be identified as a Navi. Right? She's going to be named Nivi'ah in the very beginning of her story. She's a prophet. We're going to see here, three different models of female protagonists in the story, as well as when you get into the second parak, the role of Shira, the role of the poem, which we talked about briefly in Yehoshua, because we had that weird song of the 31 dead kings. So we'll have to talk a little bit more about the role of the Shira in Tanakh. But first, we have to meet Canaan. Canaan, like Aram, like Moab, is another one of these doppelgangers. They're another one of these groups that you look at and you say, wow, that could have been us. What do we know about Canaan? Don't look at the sheet yet. What do you know about Canaan coming into this?
Yeah, it's okay. He's one of the descendants. Somewhere in Rashi. He's mentioned in Rashi.
Yes, he is. Not in a good way. He's the grandson of Noah. He's the son of Cham.
Oh, so that's during the Ash when Noah was drunk.
Right. That whole story involves Canaan. That we'll have to discuss. It's a good question. What else?
His descendants were in Israel when Joshua came.
Right? His descendants are the indigenous population. He is credited with being the ancestor of the Canaani, which we know isn't a good thing. Right? How do we know early on that the Canaani are not good, besides Hashem saying to Abraham, I'm going to give them this land eventually because these people are terrible. Their sins aren't quite complete yet, so I'm going to give them a little more time and then they're gone. What else do we know about them? Well, we met Ephron, right? We met Ephron, of the Chiti, when it came time to bury Sarah, and he decides he wants to play games with Abraham. Shechem, right? The Rebbe of Dina in Shechem, that's Canaan. Rivka. Yericho in Rahab, that's right. Yericho is another example. Remember that we talked about this when we did Yehoshua and the terrible things that Yericho did with Rahab. Not to mention both Abraham and Rivka saying, I don't want a kid marrying a Canaanite girl, right? I'd rather they marry someone from Laban's household. That's a lot better. These aren't your friends. These aren't good people. And we're going to see more about it, I'll bring you now, but these are essentially cultural degenerates. that's the way that they are depicted in. And I think I mentioned that.
I have it also.
I'm very uncomfortable. I drink it, but I drink it uncomfortably. Yeah, it's like over the label. But Eretz Yisrael.
Like call it Israel, and I think it's just generically what people think.
Oh, no. I mean, because it's a cool name. Right. It's a cool name. That's what they do.
It doesn't necessarily have to have a negative connotation when you just say it, right?
It does to me. Yeah, but no.
It's
like saying that Israel will still come on.
Well, that's the other. That's the other. Yeah. Flip the page to the other side and see what I brought you from. That first story that introduces us to Canaan. We'll explain a little bit about this because it's something you learn in school, but because of general discomfort with the story, you don't really discuss it. New battery. The sons of Noah who leave the boat are Shem, V'cham, V'yafes. V'cham hu avi Canaan. Cham is the father of Canaan. Okay, so that's how we know who Canaan is. Vayar Cham avi Canaan eis ervas aviv. I skipped the psukim which Noah gets drunk. You know the story. Cham, the father of Canaan, sees the erva of his father. Erva refers to that which should normally be covered. That's as a general rule. So Cham, the father of Canaan, sees this. And he tells his two brothers outside, who we know go back inside and they cover up their father. Noach wakes up. And he knows that which his young son did to him. And he curses Canaan to be slaves to their brethren. There's a lot going on here. Christian ministers in the U.S. in the 18th and 19th century used to justify slavery by pointing to this pasuk.
Really?
How do you know that association is incorrect?
By saying that you're a slave because you're one of Canaan and they're cursed. That's what you're saying.
There's something here that's clearly wrong.
Yeah, because the black people are not from Canaan. Right?
Well, they are within the biblical list of nations, but they're not from Canaan. He cursed Canaan. It's the wrong people. Right. It's the wrong son of Ham. Ham has four sons. Cush, Mitzrayim, Ufusu, Canaan. Cush is Ethiopia. Canaan is Canaan. You have the wrong people. I mean, there were Jews who, frankly, used the same line, so I shouldn't just...
I can't believe that you could, of course.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I had a friend, Jonathan Schorsch, who did his doctoral dissertation on the history of relations between blacks and Jews in the period from, I think he was something like 13th to 19th century. It's a very thick book. He then afterwards published it as a more popular read. It's available. And it's a scary read to see what people did and what they used as their justifications, including Jews. And the things that went on in Jewish... after I turn off the recording, I'll tell you just how bad it was. But I don't need to put that on the internet.
Why is Canaan the one who's cursed?
Yeah, so here's the problem.
If he's the one who...
Because
Ham's
father,
son. Well, he saw it, but then
his brothers
were the ones.
So there are actually three problems in these sentences, right? There are three problems. Problem number one, to make a long story short, because we're going to hit the end of our time, but we'll have to come back to this next time. Problem number one is that in the opening sentence, it tells us that Noah has three sons who leave the boat, Shem, Ham, and Yafes, and Ham is the father of Canaan. Who asked you about Ham? About Canaan, I mean. Why is he in there? So there are various midrashim which try to explain it, but that's one question we need to answer. The second question is, Ham's the one who sees this. Why is he identified as the father of Canaan when he saw it, right?
Well, it just says he was. So why?
No, but
they
say it again.
Yeah, why are you mentioning it here? And third, it says that he knew what his Beno HaKatan did to him. Ham is not Beno HaKatan. Ham is not the youngest. It's always Shem, Ham, and Yafes.
So why is Ham the one that's cursed?
Chan is either the oldest or the middle.
Why is Chan the one? Why isn't Chan the one?
Right, and then why is he the one who is cursed? So the whole thing doesn't make any sense in terms of the role, and that actually leads the Medrash to assume that Canaan was the catalyst in the story with Noach. The catalyst was not Ham, but actually Canaan was the one who set off his father in this, and it gets worse in the Medrash, it gets more graphic.
Was he the youngest grandchild, Canaan?
He would be the youngest through Ham. I don't know about all the entire family. But Canaan is depicted as having a more active role in this story, and this is your introduction to who your neighbors are going to be when you move into the land. This is the man this land is named for. So, and that just plays out further, which we'll talk about, I guess, God willing, next week. Yeah, it is his grandson.